Did you see that?
What was it?
It was a woolly rhinoceros chasing a bunch of Neanderthals.
God, this whole area is going crazy.
I know, right? Yesterday it was the giant ground sloths.
Oh, I missed that. What time was that?
I beg your pardon?
What time did that happen?
I don't know what you mean.
Time, like a really specific part of the day? We need a better system.
We get up, we do stuff, we go to sleep. What's wrong with that?
Okay, let's say I wanted to meet up with you.
You're with me right now.
No, but later.
Define later.
A certain amount of the day would have passed.
You could just go look for me?
Okay, well, imagine this. What if I had a thing, like on my wrist, and you had a thing on your wrist, and then we could look at it and know what part of the day it was, and I could be like, hey, you know, let's meet by the berry bushes when our wrist things say, you know, whatever.
Okay, now you're talking really crazy.
Maybe, but maybe not.
Seriously, that is crazy talk.
Yeah, you said that about the wheel.
This is different. This magical wrist thing, don't even mention it to anyone else, okay?
Okay, well, I gotta run.
Yeah, see you tomorrow.
Okay, what time?
Huh?
Got you. And now, the guy who's always late for the Smilodon roast, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, so those are two more or less Neolithic people trying to figure out how to order their days when they have no particular way of measuring time, and one of them at least has no concept of time whatsoever. That's a little bit of what we're going to talk about today. All we're going to do for the next 49 minutes is explain time to you. So we should have lots of time left over. That's not a very big job, right? We should have 19 minutes probably left over to do something else. Now, This show takes a big bite out of a very big topic. We're going to start with the author of Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation written by Alan Burdick. I want to say that Alan will be with us for the entirety of the show. We're going to go from kind of the human dimension to the world of physics, and then in the end towards music, a place where time distortions occasionally intentionally happen. But Alan Burdick, thank you for anchoring this conversation with me.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
I want to begin with something that hadn't occurred to me until I read your book, and that is, I mean, I guess I sort of knew this, but I never really thought about it this way. Sometime in the 1960s, we flipped our way of measuring time on its head, that basically our way of understanding time had been based on rotations of the Earth and revolutions of the Earth around the sun. So time was taking place out there in outer space, at some kind of bird's eye view of Earth. And we changed it so that we're actually measuring time from some of the smallest substances here on the ground. How did that happen, or why did that happen?
Well, you can kind of think of the time in terms of how we measure the time of day from two directions. One is kind of top down, and you know, you've got the rotation of the Earth, and you got 24 hours, and you can divide that up into minutes, and then you've got 86,400 seconds in a day. So the second is kind of a mathematical abstraction. It's a subdivision. But coming along in the 1960s, it was realized that one problem with that approach is that the rotation of the Earth is actually gradually slowing down. So 1/86,400th of a second, just gets a little bit longer each and every day. So scientists came up with another way to do it, which is basically from the bottom up. Let's measure a second using, a cesium atom, which vibrates 9 billion plus times per second. And then you can, you know, you've got your seconds, and you can add those into minutes, and you can add those into hours, and you can tell the time like that. That's been the way we've done it. But the problem is still that the Earth is slowing down. So those two kinds of seconds are gradually coming, you know, They don't quite measure the same amount. So every few years, we have to add into our calendar a leap second.
So one of the things that you talk about in your book are these entities and organizations that, including the charming, located in Greater Paris, BIPM, entities and organizations that, to use your verb, produce time. And in that sense, time is kind of a product. Time doesn't exist because that's how long it takes the Earth to revolve around the sun. And it time doesn't exist because of the pulsations of the cesium atom. Time exists because we want it to. I don't know. Agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, I mean, the language of time production is, I just find it great. So in the United States and in really all the major nations, we have what are called atomic clocks. And what atomic clocks do are they realize seconds, and they produce seconds. And based on those seconds, that you can pile them up and, as I said, you know, kind of tell the time of day. And it's very accurate. And in the U.S., all of our smartphones and computer clocks all reference the clocks either in Colorado or in Washington, D.C., and the same thing around the world. But, of course, the problem with, you know, clocks or, you know, realizing seconds is that what if everybody isn't exactly right? So there's this agency in Paris called the International Bureau of Weights and Measures. And one of the things they do is every month they have all the major international clocks around the world, there are about 60 of them, realize their seconds at the same time so that the Bureau can kind of measure who's faster and who's slower, right? And they compile all this information. It takes a few days. And then they send out basically a newsletter, a piece of email that tells all the clocks, well, you know, for the sake of the average, maybe next time you could slow down a little bit or just speed up a little bit. So in that sense, what's called international coordinated time is not actually a clock. I kind of assumed that there was some clock somewhere that we were all getting our information from. But it's really this newsletter where they're processing the information from last month's clocks and feeding it all into next month's calculations. It's super weird.
Yes, and it's very head exploding because you start asking yourself the question, where does time exist? In other words, we can see something change, right? We can watch a tree for a period of time and see the tree change. And so I guess you could argue we're observing the passage of time at that point. But you can't really see time. And the question then becomes, does time exist mainly inside us? Think about those two cavemen in the cave persons in the introduction. You know, they need time so they can figure out when to meet at the berry bush. So they need some way of measuring a thing. But what's the thing? Where does the thing exist?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it's probably important to point out at this stage. A realization that I came to really early in this project. I started going around and talking to psychologists and neuroscientists and basically asking them, what is time? And they would all come back to me and they would say, well, what do you mean by time exactly? And it turns out that what we refer to as time, you know, just one word, is actually, you know, half a dozen or maybe even a dozen different experiences that we sort of lump under the same term. So there's knowing what time of day it is. There is understanding the difference between before and after, which is something that kids don't actually get till they're like 4 years old. There's understanding the, you know, the past and the present and the future. There's understanding why, you know, things that happen at the same time. And there's this sense we also have of, you know, this kind of perpetual now that is passing through us. These are all really distinct experiences. And so we have to kind of really be careful about, you know, about our terms.
Right. And it does seem as though if you take living organisms out of the equation, it all gets very different. But let's talk about people for starters. One of the things you look at a lot in the book is whether or not we have built-in clocks. So one possible built-in clock that we have is this so-called kind of circadian clock, this notion that every cell in our body is somehow or other marking time or at least aware of time. I know this is, you know, a 40-minute conversation, but in considerably less than that. Tell us what you found out.
You're right. So in each of our cells, we have basically a clock that ticks out a 24-hour rhythm. And the way that does that very quickly is that, you know, in the nucleus of the cell, there are basically a pair of genes that code for a pair of proteins that go out into the cell and do some stuff out there, and then they kind of build up, and then they make their way back into the nucleus, and they turn the genes off that produce them in the first place. And that whole process takes 24 hours. And that is kind of a way of marking time, but all of our cells have this. Conglomerations of cells have this. Your liver basically has a 24-hour clock where it's less active at certain times of day and more active at others. Same thing with your kidneys. Same thing with your heart. You know, your heart is most efficient at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Your body temperature is reliably lowest early in the morning before you wake up and highest at about midday. So these clocks are really important in regulating our physiology. And to do that, they have to speak to each other, just like, you know, your clock and my clock. If we're going to, you know, talk at 1 p.m., we need to know how to tell the time and coordinate. It's the exact same thing going on with your cells.
So it should be, if all of that's true, I mean, it sounds very Swiss, you know, all this stuff that's going on and they're talking to each other. And it's, so it should be the case, Alan, that if you were to put me in a cave for 60 days and tell me you were going to take me out in 60 days, and I'm actually describing something that did happen to somebody else, not me, and that my all those clocks would just kind of keep working, right? I could be in total darkness and have no information from the outside world about what time it was or what day it was, and I should be able to keep track of some things anyway. What did they find out when they tried something like that?
Yeah, you're exactly right, and you know the same is true in plants. This was known in the 1700s that if you took certain kinds of flowering plants and put them in a dark closet for a couple of weeks, they would continue to bloom at, you know, what they assumed was morning and close up at night. And that would go on even in the absence of light. And so, you know, come the 1960s, humans decided to see if this would happen to us too. And it is true that your body temperature will continue to oscillate, you know, high, low over a 24-hour period. But what also happens is that your circadian clock is not exactly the same length as the actual length of day and night. So, you know, after 60 days, you will be really out of sync. If you're just counting oscillations of your body temperature, you will, you know, pretty soon you're going to be out of sync with daylight. And so there was this guy, Michel Seif, who was a French cave explorer, and he went down into a cave for a couple of months because he wanted to see what it was like to live without time. And before his time was up, his colleagues up above said, hey, you know, it's time to come out. And he thought, well, no, not enough time has gone by. And they said, oh, yeah, sure, it has. And sure enough, he had really lost track of time according to day and night.
Now, there's another way that you could conceivably actually, before we get to that one, let's talk a little bit more about kids. So Jean Piaget studied kids, and after Einstein asked him a question at Davos, I love this Davos conference. It's so much better than the Davos conferences they have now. But anyway, so you've got all these, you know, great minds at Davos, and Einstein says to Piaget, well, what do you know? What do children know about velocity? What do they know about time? What do they know about? And Piaget says, I don't know what they know about that. And he goes back and he starts studying it. And one of the things he finds out, looking at 4 to 6-year-old children, is that, you know, I mean, if we really are kind of innately time-perceiving creatures, you know, we ought to be pretty time-perceiving from the get-go, right? That ought to be, you know, almost as basic as our ability to tell light from dark or hot from cold, right? If we're like little, you know, biological clocks, we should know these things. But the kids really didn't. I mean, the one that I thought was fascinating was Piaget would push a little truck around a room and have the kid push a little truck around the room, and he'd intentionally go a little bit faster than the kid, and then they would both stop, and he'd be ahead of the kid, and he'd say, who stopped first? And the kid would say, oh, I stopped first. His perception being, well, he must have stopped first, because the Piaget's truck is ahead of his. Like, he wasn't really necessarily able to perceive the location of an event in time.
Yeah, that was kind of Einstein's question to Piaget. You know, Einstein's interested in time and space, and Einstein's curious about the young brain and how does it, you know, perceive time and space as one? or are those kind of two separate things? And so Piaget does all these experiments with trains, you know, that he stops and starts them at the same time, but one moves faster than the other. And it's like, you know, did they stop at the same time? Yes. Did they start at the same time? Yes. Did one move farther than the other? Yes. Did one move faster than the other? No. And Piaget really kind of began to point out that what we think of as time, all these different facets of time, really are not innate. And, you know, for instance, a kid of 2 or 3 years old will use the past tense and the present tense, but it's not really until they're about 4 years old that they understand the difference between before and after. I mean, I remember my kids, one of them when he was three, he was sort of in a reveille about this babysitter that had stopped by to say hi a few weeks earlier. And I said, well, you know, that was about 3 months ago. And he said, well, when is it going to be 3 months again?
Let's talk about another way in which human beings can have a different kind of relationship with time. So back on the beloved series Star Trek, you know, they do talk about this all the time. I mean, Captain Kirk would say to, you know, report down to the engine room and you better hurry. You've only got 15 years because, in fact, of course, you know, at that point, they'd be moving really, really, really fast, much faster than the people back home, wherever home was. And because of relativity, we know that that actually sort of changes the nature of time. But as you say, in a much more pedestrian way, I guess it's not really pedestrian, but if you're on an airplane going really fast in the sky, you're actually experiencing time at a different rate. Explain this.
Well, Richard Muller is going to do a much better job of explaining it than I will. But it really has to do with the frame of reference and how fast you're going with regard to the speed of light. So if you're up in a plane or even higher up going at a faster rate and you have a clock on board with you, you know, you're sitting next to the clock. Clock is ticking away 1 second per tick. But from the reference point of someone on Earth, it seems as though, well, it not only seems as though, it is the case that your clock is actually ticking, faster than a clock on Earth. Mm-hmm. And that's a function of Earth's gravity, of acceleration. This is something that Einstein predicted, but didn't really become clearly experimentally proven until the 70s.
Now, we're speeding all over the place here, like an airplane. I'm just trying to at least touch down on a few of the really interesting areas in your book. By the way, we're talking to Alan Burdick. His book is Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. We can only skim the surface. I recommend getting the book and plunging in a little deeper. But, you know, I think it can also be argued, as you explore, that one of the reasons that humans care so much about time, the reason that maybe time is not just this kind of slightly emergent phenomenon that occasionally intrudes on our thoughts or whatever, is because our time is finite. Let's again go to Star Trek. This is Malcolm McDowell playing Dr. Soron.
Aren't you beginning to feel time gaining on you? It's like a predator. It's stalking you. Oh, you can try and outrun it with doctors, medicines, new technologies. But in the end, time is going to hunt you down and make the kill.
Time is going to hunt you down and make the kill. So, you know, at the level of just existence, I think all of us, I mean, you couldn't think about it that way all the time or you'd go mad. But we all have moments, and we have more of them, Alan. I think as we get older, I'm older than you are, where we become keenly aware that time only flows in one direction, that we are on a river that only flows in one direction. We can't go backwards on the river, you know, and the river is taking us to a very specific destination. How much does that, I mean, maybe that's one of the reasons that human beings are these kinds of time-eating animals, time-producing and time-eating animals, because it's a matter of vital concern to us in a way that it isn't to a coconut.
Yeah, well, among developmental psychologists, a lot of them will say that a sense of self is really an understanding of the sense of self through time. You know, your understanding that the person that you were yesterday or last week is the same person that you are now, is the same person that you will be, you know, 50 or 60 years from now. And that's not actually an awareness that, we have as humans until, you know, age 3, 4, or 5. And I, you know, once you kind of come into this realization, and I remember it distinctly with my kids when they were 4 and 5 years old, you know, suddenly the light's going on. And as soon as you start thinking about, you know, I'm the same person now and I will always be the same me, you start thinking about, well, what is always? How long is always? And then I started getting all these questions about, you know, how long am I going to live for? And, you know, who's going to eat my birthday cake when I die? you know, we often talk about the sense that time is speeding up as we get older, that the years go by faster as we get older. And what the studies actually seem to suggest is that it's not so much that the years go by faster, it's that our years are, number one, kind of more scheduled than ever, and we are more conscious of time than ever, in part because, you know, maybe we are getting older and kind of thinking about the end zone. And so time just becomes takes up a greater fraction of our thinking day.
Right. You know, you quote Heidegger as saying, existentially, time gains its value from finitude. You know, I think probably the closer we are to the end, the more that we start to value the time and the more it seems as though there's not enough of it. Whereas when we were kids and we were bored, there sometimes seemed to be too much of it. All right. So we're going to take a break. We're as if things weren't head spinning and brain exploding enough. We're going to add a physicist to the mix. And you know what that does.
What's time to a hog? What's a Nobel Prize to a toad or a fiddle to a frog? What's time to a hog?
What the hell am I looking at? When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
What happened to then?
We passed then.
When?
Just now. We're at now now.
Go back to then.
When?
Now.
Now?
Now.
I can't.
Why?
We missed it.
When?
Just now.
All right. That's from Spaceballs, and it sets up our next conversation. We still have with us Alan Burdick, a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. We also have with us Richard Muller, professor emeritus of physics at UC Berkeley, winner of a MacArthur Prize and lots and lots and lots of other prizes, and the author of several books, most recently and significantly now, The Physics of Time. So, Richard Muller, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
This feels a little bit like a test for which I did not study adequately, but I really did absolutely do my best. So I think maybe we can begin where I think you begin, which is by asking why the arrow of time points and races into the future, as opposed to, as that clip suggests, to the past, to back then. What has been thought about this, and what are your changing thoughts about this?
Well, the standard explanation connects it to a concept in physics called entropy, which just means that things tend to get more scattered, they get more random as time goes on. The entropy theory states that the reason time goes on is because of entropy, that the changing complexity of the world, the fact that things get more spread out, sometimes it's called heading towards higher confusion, that this is what sets the arrow of time. That was my starting point, because I first learned of this when I was a graduate student in physics, and it didn't seem right to me. But wiser, smart people had said this. Eddington, one of the great heroes of physics up there with Einstein, had put forth this theory. It was generally accepted by many people. I asked other scientists about this, and their typical answer was, well, maybe it's entropy. That's the theory. I don't really know. As time went on, I became more and more convinced that this was absolutely wrong, that the increase of entropy was a result of the fact that time goes on. And that was really the beginning of my serious thought into this subject. Time is different from space. In relativity theory, Einstein said space and time are just different dimensions of the same four-dimensional space-time. And if you look at relativity, and I finally did study relativity, began to know it, actually did experiments in relativity, you find that space and time are treated on a completely equal footing. And yet, in our own experience, you can stand still in space, but you can't stand still in time. That breaks the symmetry. There's something mysterious going on there. That's really how I got started on this.
You know, one question that I know some physicists have is how much status to assign to time? Because we could go a little further than you just went in suggesting that time, whatever it is different from a dimension of space. And we could say that, you know, if and when there is a grand unified theory of everything, will time turn out to be written into the fundamental equations? Will it have, you know, that basic a status? Or will it be this kind of emergent function? I mean, are we giving time too much credit? Is it going to exist? Does it exist the same way as these other dimensions? Where do you land on that one?
Well, there are physicists who seriously write the idea that time is an illusion, that it doesn't really exist, that we just think it does. What we really have is just a series of events. And we connect them through this illusion called time. That strikes me as certainly not physics, certainly not scientific. It's some sort of a spiritual, religious way to look at things. The role of physics is to explain things within this realm in which we exist, not to simply deny the existence of time. And we all experience time. It's a great mystery to us. And the role of physics is to explain the mysteries, not to dismiss them. I think many theorists do this because the current theories, the current unified theories, the string theories, I know all about these things. Mm-hmm. They don't address this question. They don't even begin to address this question. And it does not, even if we have a grand unified theory 5 years from now, which explains everything, it won't explain this. There's no real progress made on this subject since, well, actually Einstein, and then Feynman made some progress on it in the 1950s. And since then, physics has ignored the issue.
Yeah, and I want to come back in just a second, Rich Mueller, to some pretty fascinating experiments that you've been involved in that give us some actual kind of hard data about at least one aspect of this question. But let me switch over to Alan Burdick for a second. I mean, in fact, you know, what Professor Mueller is saying, I think, is true, that in some ways, although physics treats of time, it maybe doesn't treat of time as thoroughly, extensively, avidly, enthusiastically as it treats of other topics. And as a result, we really do rely on people like St. Augustine and William James, people who were not physicists, to tell us what they think about time. And to a certain degree, each of them, although they do it a little bit differently, Alan, it does seem that each of them kind of says, well, time actually resides inside us as opposed to anywhere else.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, they would probably both agree that, you know, time is something that we occupy. It's not an illusion in the sense that, you know, it doesn't exist. But they were primarily concerned with the psychological process. And they both said to a certain degree, look, you know, we talk about the past, present, and the future, but really only one of those three is actually something that we reside in, and that is the present. As Augustine said, there's the present of our you know, kind of recollection of memory, and there's our present expectation of what's going to happen, the future, and then there's our present attention. And James said something similar. He was like, you know, forget all the tenses and everything. Let's just deal with what I'm going to call the specious present. There's this span of time, you know, maybe it's half a second long, maybe it's a couple of seconds long, in which, you know, we kind of clearly perceive something. You can perceive the beginning and the end of a sentence, or, you know, you can perceive a meteorite passing through the sky. At the time that James was writing, there were a number of German experimentalists who were really preoccupied with trying to measure how long now is, as a kind of a proxy for a measure of consciousness. And to James, that was all just really tedious. He called it microscopic psychology. And he was just much more interested in you know, the kind of phenomenological experience of it.
So hard to strip away consciousness from our understanding of time. Professor Muller, I have a couple of questions that are asked from a position of profound ignorance, but striving ignorance. I'm trying to understand. One of the questions that I have has to do with the quantum level. I think I've read about particle experiments in which something that happens to a particle at time moment n seems to affect that particle, the status of that particle at time n minus 1. So, I mean, does time always flow forward even at the quantum level?
Well, this was the concept that I refer to of Richard Feynman. Mm-hmm. Feynman in the 1950s came up with a way of looking at elementary particles that actually had backward time flow in it. Mm-hmm. Now, that was just an interpretation of his equations. His equations were able to really predict things better than anything we have had before or since. The equations that he came up with for electromagnetism involved this term that can be interpreted as things moving backward in time, but that's just an interpretation. See, in physics, time, flow of time, and even causality don't have any real direction to them. Time, even in the Feynman equations, is just a parameter, and you could put in a negative time to that. But my interpretation of Feynman's equations are that they do not allow backward flow of time. They are equations, and that's a nice way to visualize them. But I think of time more as a issue of free will. One can actually apply physics to the concept of free will and come up with meaningful results. You know, time wasn't part of physics until Einstein made it part of physics. And then he showed that physics can actually say some things about time. You can show that the rate of time flow is different depending on your altitude. Mm-hmm. Time flows faster upstairs than it does downstairs. And this has been measured. It's really true. Einstein put time into the realm of physics. And I was surprised as I worked on this subject to recognize that one can also incorporate in the issue of free will. And I'm also a fan of Augustine. I thought he had one of the greatest insights into the nature of time of any past writer. But I give a different interpretation to the present. The present in the way the physics works out is the present is the only moment in the flow of time when we can exercise our free will. That's an astonishing thing, I think, to be hearing from a physicist. But it does fit into physics, and the whole issue of free will actually does come into physics. It's related to the concept in physics we call causality.
Hmm. Before we run out of time, you should pardon the expression, we should actually talk about, this is sort of like the really good news from a certain point of view, if you think there's not enough time. Well, it turns out the universe might be making more time for you, just in the same sense that the universe is expanding spatially. Some of your experiments, Professor Muller, suggest that the universe is expanding chronologically, time-wise, that the coalescing of black holes seems to produce more time.
Well, it's really the growth of the universe. The theory that I've come up with, which is explained in my book, is that new time is being created along with new space. As the universe expands, and we know the universe is expanding, we even know it's accelerating, that with every cubic mile of new space that's created, we create a microsecond of new time. And it's not entropy. Entropy is a result of time. It's the expansion of space that is giving us these new times. When people say we exist in the now, in my analysis of this, we exist in the past also. But we can't change the past, and so it's less interesting to us. The only time when we can exercise free will is in the present. And we can exercise free will because of quantum physics. quantum physics tells us that the future is not determined by the past. There's something else that comes in. It doesn't prove we have free will, but modern physics with quantum mechanics no longer contradicts the concept of free will.
We're going to have to stop there, although obviously we're just kind of getting started in some ways, but we've got to take a break here. I do want to say we're having a pledge drive next week, and one of the things we'll be doing is for a gift of $60 or more to WNPR, we will give you a microsecond of newly created time, time that, you know, actually has only recently, it's like timeshares, sort of, you know, you'll get some extra time that has only recently been created elsewhere in the universe, and I believe... that may be as good as some of the other things we've given you in the past. All right, we're going to take a break. Alan Burdick staying with us. We're going to talk about a place, a very familiar place, a place you're hearing right now, where time can change.
I'm gonna do the credits now. Dang it, I missed it. That now is part of the past. The only way to do it is to kind of sneak up on now. There, that's now. Well, it was. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our intern is Hazel Colon. The part of Bill Curry was played by Seth Thomas. Keep up with our doings by visiting the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. And now, back to Colin.
All right. So we want to talk a little bit about how we perceive time in certain situations, particularly music. There's something a little bit seductive about music. But Alan Burdick, before we go to that, before we join Jonathan Berger via Skype from Rome, Jonathan Berger, composer, researcher, and professor of music in the Center for Computer Research in Music and Acoustics at Stanford University, currently a Rome Prize recipient at the American Academy in Rome, and a 2016 Guggenheim Fellow. Wow, I want his life. I want to be in Rome right now. Alan Burdick, actually, you quote a friend of ours in your book, Dan Lloyd, professor at Trinity College, talking about subjective time. He says, the thing that strikes me about subjective time is how bad we are in comparison to a stopwatch. We're inconsistent in all sorts of aspects and subject to all kinds of manipulations. It's a mystery to me that we function as well as we do. So, Alan, this makes the point that, you know, our perception of time has a lot to do with what else is going on around us. Maybe you can elaborate.
Yeah, and by perception of time, I think we're talking about sort of perception of duration, and it turns out to be really fluid. So, for instance, if you know, I show you a series of faces on a computer monitor, all for the same brief duration, like a second or a couple of seconds, an angry face will seem to last longer to you on screen than a happy face, and a happy face will seem to last longer to you than a sad face. And even stranger, if I have you put a pencil between your teeth, that effect goes away. The reason has to do with this thing that we all do with each other without even noticing it, which is we mimic each other's gestures and mimic each other's faces. You know, so if you're looking at a computer monitor and I'm kind of slipping in there some pictures of smiling people so fast that you don't register them, you will nonetheless smile every time a smiling face shows up. And so the idea is that actually what's going on in these kind of time-bending moments is that we're almost stepping inside the skin of that face, and we are experiencing the emotion that is on that face. So what is bending time is basically a product of empathy, our ability to kind of place ourselves in other people and experience other people's emotions, and so we're kind of bending time in conversation with each other all the time, and it's sort of critical to our ability to get along and have social chemistry.
So, Jonathan Berger, one of the things that we know is that people's experience of time in music can differ drastically from the elapsed time as counted on a stopwatch. And sometimes that's just kind of a consequence of the music. Sometimes it's the intended purpose or one of the central purposes of the music. Let's hear a little bit of A Rainbow in Curved Air by Terry Riley, which I would place in that latter category. So Jonathan Berger, anybody who can keep track of anything while listening to that is a better man than I am. There's a lot that goes on when music is playing. This is something that you've become very interested in, the way in which music distorts time. Can you give us kind of a nutshell version of your theory about this? And we might not have him. Hold on. We're going to try to reestablish our connection with... I hear a Skype thing happening there. All right. We are trying to make contact with, first of all, with Alan Burdick, who we have right now, and then Jonathan Berger, composer, researcher, and professor of music in the Center for Computer Research and Music and Acoustics at Stanford University, currently a Rome recipient at the Academy, a Rome Prize recipient at the American Academy in Rome, a 2016 Guggenheim Fellow. We might have him right now through the miracle of Skype. Jonathan Berger, can you hear me?
Yeah, it's a rotten connection, but I'm here.
All right. Actually, you sound pretty good on our end. So I was just playing a little bit of Terry Riley's A Rainbow in Curved Air. That would be probably an example of a piece of music that intentionally means to distort our perception of time. But how does music accomplish that? Is there a particular way that music makes us experience time a different way than we would just counting it on a stopwatch? Uh-oh. All right. We might have to break away from that and go back to Alan for just a second. This is the problem with using Skype. We had a Richard Mueller's connection was on Skype, and it sounded great. We're struggling right now with Jonathan Berger. So, Alan, I will come back to you, and I know that you also have been reading some of Jonathan Berger's writing. But in general, you know, we can talk a little bit more about how the environment that we're in, whether we're in a museum, whether we're listening to music, all of that has a way of distorting whatever kind of innate rhythm we have that allows us to count time.
Yeah, there was a great kooky experiment that was done a couple of years ago where, you know, instead of showing you faces of, you know, angry faces or happy faces on a screen, they would show you a picture of a Degas sculpture. You know, one of his sculptures of the ballerina in basically full arabesque, very dynamic. And then they would show you a similar one of a ballerina basically at rest, standing at rest. And the tendency was for viewers to feel like the dancer in motion seemed to last on screen longer than the other one did. And again, that seems to be because what is going on is that we are, you know, placing ourselves. It's almost like you're placing yourself in the body of the dancer. A lot of studies indicate that moving images seem to last longer in duration than static images of, you know, even if the two are exactly the same length. So, you know, you walk into a, I mean, maybe even, you know, maybe Degas had something like that in mind where, you know, you by viewing this dynamic pose, it would seem to kind of stretch out in time.
So that raises the question of whether we can be fiendishly manipulated by people who want us to perceive time differently. I mean, we know, for example, that in casinos there are no clocks because they don't want you thinking about that, about what time it is or how long you've been there. But it just seems that if our experience of time is that fungible, you know, we would seem to be, you know, available to various kinds of outside manipulation for the purpose of exploiting us.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, and it kind of gets back to Dan Lloyd's question of if our, you know, if our sense of timing or if our sense of duration is so plastic, what good is it? And I think some would argue that the whole point of it being plastic is that it gives us, you know, as a social species, kind of room to interact in. And again, these kind of you know, flexions of time, if we can call them that, are manifestations of empathy. You know, the better that you and I get along together, the more likely we are when we're in conversation and in person to mimic each other's gestures and to kind of step in and out of each other in that way.
All right, I think we have Jonathan Berger by a conventional phone connection. I've already introduced him twice, so I'm not going to tell you who he is now. But we do know if you want to mess with somebody's perception of time, music's a great way to do it. People buy more drinks in bars that play slow tempo music. Consumers spend more time in the grocery store when the background music is slow. Drivers drive faster when the tempo is rapid. So Jonathan Berger, what do we know about this? I mean, how is it that we can be hijacked out of our normal perception of time by music?
So I think there's sort of three angles on this. And first, let me just riff on something that Alan writes. Alan talks about time as being contagious. In other words, the subjectivity of time is something that we pass on from one to the other. And I think that if I completely agree with that. I think that if music, in a way, is sort of the infectious host of that. It's music that actually allows gives the tool to give a sense of warp time. And I think one way to think about this is that Marvin Minsky, who's the sort of the father of artificial intelligence, famously once asked why we're so fixated on Beethoven's Fifth. And if you think about it, it's a bunch of da-da-da-das that repeat themselves forever. And his answer was, just as children learn about spatial relationships by playing with blocks, we have no mechanism to learn about time. And so these give us sort of discrete units of time to play with. But it's within those units that the magic happens. And so, and it happens at many different scales. And so when Alan talks about the smile factor and how that affects perceptual time, and one of the things I always point out to my students is that when you're talking on a cell phone, and it's someone that you know within a microsecond if they're smiling. And so what is the sound of a smile? I mean, there's something so subtle that happens there. And that, in a way, is sort of the primary example of musically warped time.
So we had two clips from your own compositions, which, thanks to Skype, we're not going to have time to play, which is too bad. But one thing, Jonathan Berger, that modern composers do is that they try to create, in some cases, what another Jonathan Kramer called vertical time, which mm-hmm. kind of doesn't have a future or past, only kind of exists in the present moment. Is that part of what you're talking about, just the use of music to change time?
Absolutely, and I don't think it's new. I mean, my awakening to music happened about 40 years ago when I heard string quintet by Schubert. The slow movement of that C major string quintet literally stops time, and it warps the perception of time. And over the years, I've asked many musicians who've played the piece for their time estimates on it, and it's staggering how way off they are. So I think there are pieces that go back to Bach and before that play with perceptual time intentionally.
All right. And this is a conversation that I would like to extend in time, and maybe we can return to it on another day. But our time right now is essentially gone. We want to thank Jonathan Berger, composer, researcher, and professor at music from Stanford University. Alan Burdick, the book is Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. We also talked to Professor Richard Muller, whose book is Now, The Physics of Time. It's almost time to go. I do want to thank Betsy Kaplan for producing this show, Kyone Wolf for making it sing. We'll be back tomorrow with The Nose.
And it's time that you and it's time.
This is WNPR.
Frank, stop.
I can't stop.
Well, the timing of the show, it's pretty precise. It ends at a certain time.
I do love being in front of the mic and reading scripts.
Okay, I get that. It's fine. We'll just fix this in post.
It's been my pleasure to spend the time with you and also have a chance to talk directly to the listeners of my member station.
Yeah, okay, it's time. You can do it now.